Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. We all know that for some, the strongest force in the universe is a mother's love. But what about the dads? Whereas a mother forsaking her child is unthinkable, a deadbeat dad who leaves his family is sometimes all too often common. Why do fathers even matter? We are here today with scientist Paul Rayburn, author of Do Fathers Matter, to tell us how science tries to answer that question. Now sit back and think of your own father as we talk about everything from genetics to salaries, culture to monogamy. Fathers are no longer just the masculine breadwinners of generations past. A father is now so much more, including nurturer and caretaker. We'll find out why human evolution has kept dads in the game. And maybe Paul will help us rethink what we write in our card next time Father's Day rolls around. Paul, welcome to my show. It is a definite pleasure in having you, and I loved your book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now, you yourself are a father. So let me ask you a question. Should the title of the book actually be Do I Matter rather than Do Fathers Matter?
Well, I used a little bit of my own experience in the book, but mostly I tried to do what I think is a very important thing. We all walk around with a head full of notions about fathers and mothers and who's best at what, and you know, that we've picked up from our parents and from, you know, who knows, sitcoms on television, I don't know what, wherever we pick these things up. And so what I wanted to do with this book was to really separate what we actually know about fathers and their contributions to their kids, to separate that from all the things we think we know, a lot of which might turn out to be a bunch of nonsense and does in fact turn out to be a bunch of nonsense. So I used some of my own experience, but I didn't, you know, it's certainly not another book. There are more than enough already of books about new parents, you know, going on and on about how wonderful their kids are. You know, we all think we have the most wonderful kids, and that's fine. But we don't necessarily need to read any more about everybody else's kids in that respect.
Paul, I absolutely love and want to hear all the scientific basis. But I want you to realize, and I'm sure you do, that so many parents think they have the worst kids in the world. You know, meaning I've been doing what I'm doing, executive life coach and neuroplasticity medical hypnosis for 37 years. I get parents telling me they wish the kids were never born. So it's kind of interesting how that some parents naturally protect their children, just like some fathers naturally protect their children, and some don't. I remember one.
No, I was a little bit facile there in saying that we all think we have the best kids in the world. I mean, certainly on good days, many of us think that when the kids are doing well and they're happy and things are moving along. But no question. A lot of American families, and not only America, but around the world, but a lot of families are in a lot of pain and suffering. And I was wrong to not make that point. I'm glad you corrected me.
Thank you. So tell me what makes a good father. And tell me, by the way, are fathers, human fathers, different from fathers in the animal?
Right. Okay. So first of all, what makes a good father? So that's a very complicated thing, and Do Fathers Matter is full of a lot of data and evidence that speaks to that question. But I can give you a couple of key points. One is the quality of the relationship between fathers and their children. So it's important that fathers spend time with kids. It's important that fathers ask them about school and all kinds of things, but What's really important is that fathers listen to their children and that they treat them with warmth and affection. So there was a notion, now this is what I mean by the kinds of things we walk around with that we think are true but turn out not to be true. There was a notion going back actually to World War II. A lot of young American men were failing their physicals for the armed services. And so the question was, what's wrong? Why are so many of these young men failing their physicals? And all the experts, and if this were TV, I'd be crinkling my fingers to say experts in quotes, all the supposed experts knew exactly what the problem was. Fathers were being too soft with children. They weren't exercising proper discipline, and their sons were not growing up to be tough enough for the armed forces. Now, nobody questioned that for a good bit of time until years later, some psychologists decided to take a look at that. And they found out that the answer, the truth, is exactly the opposite. And it all makes sense if you think about it a little bit. Now, a stern disciplinarian father, we know about those from the movies. Some of us know about those from our own families or perhaps grandparents or stories from grandparents. A stern disciplinarian is not necessarily going to be loved and admired by his son. He might be feared. He might be respected. But there's not a lot of warmth there. So what happens is that the son, and this is no surprise, the son does not seek to emulate the father. He doesn't like the father. So he rebels against, you know, the sort of traditional male traits of discipline and self-control and that sort of thing. And that was the problem with the child rearing. It turned out that the fathers who were, you know, engaged with their sons had good, healthy, warm relationships. Those kids wanted to emulate their dads, and they grew up much more fit and qualified for the service. So one of many examples where, you know, what we think is important is not important, and the research shows something else. Another key thing that makes a good father, and this might sound a little bit silly, but it's actually quite important, is play. One of the most important things fathers do for their kids is play with them. And the reason that's important is because fathers play with kids differently than mothers do. As a rule, there are plenty of exceptions, and both parents play all kinds of ways. But in general, fathers are more likely to roll around on the floor, tickle the kids, jump out from behind the couch, surprise them, run around the house, and do all kinds of silly, physical, crazy things that kids, that most kids love. And that helps to encourage that warm relationship. Also, that kind of unstructured play and surprise and, you know, that kind of complicated social interaction creates what is sometimes called, you know, the father who's a bridge to the outside world. So it helps to prepare the child, you know, to move from the protected, you know, comfort of the family in later years into the world where things are surprising and unexpected and more complicated social situations. So play turns out to be one of those really important things that fathers do for children, which is nice because most fathers like playing too.
No. I think you're right on. One of the things that I used to do with my kids, I have two girls, now they're 35 and 31. But when they were younger, when they were, you know, real young, and actually throughout their life, I would wake one of them up, always separately, at 3, 4 in the morning on a school night. And I would bring them for ice cream sodas. As they got older, I would bring them to play pool or bowling. As they got older, I'd wake them up, you know, for, you know, to something more adult. And the, you know, the fact that they were woken up by their father to have a special dad time outside of the context of the home just caused, you know, 35 years. And, you know, I just never had a problem with my kids. And I'm, you know, close as could be.
That sounds great. Can I steal that one? I might try that.
It works. It works so well. Because what happens is when you get a kid out of their environment, they just open up and then they tell all their friends, and now you're cool to their friends, which makes them even feel cooler. It's kind of great. I want to jump into something you said, and I find it fascinating. In your book, you mentioned that when women find men more attractive, it has an influence with the offspring. Now, why?
Well, this gets back actually to the earlier question, which we got away from, which is about human fathers and animal fathers. And so let me just address that briefly. Humans, whether we like it or not, no matter how high-minded we think we are animals. Yes, it's true. And so many of the things we do resemble hymns and animals, and we can learn a lot from animals and how they either help raise their offspring or don't in most cases. So one of the things that's interesting about fathers is that for more attractive fathers, mothers will put more resources into the children. Now, one of the places, I use the word children advisedly here, because one of the places this phenomenon was found was in research with zebra finches. These are tiny little birds, about the size of sparrows, maybe a little smaller. And they're very chattery, noisy things. At Columbia University, where I went to see this research, you can hear them walking down the hall, even with the door closed. They're very interesting because, you know, birds are among the small minority of animals that actually, in which the fathers help rear the offspring, right? Fathers help build the nest. They sometimes tend the eggs, depending on the species, do all those things. So these zebra finches turned out to be good animals to study. And so I think this was initially found by accident, but the birds were tagged. And it turned out that those males, you know, certain males given colorful tags, which is sort of a little ring on one of their legs. It appeared that when they mated, those females had offspring that grew more quickly, weighed more, and seemed to be prospering and getting more resources from the mother than other offspring. And they eventually realized that the ring sort of mimicked a sort of feathery display that the males will use. And the females thought the ring was attractive. So when they mated with a male that had this attractive ring, they put more resources in their offspring. And this is an evolutionary finding. So what it means is, you know, attractiveness, for us, attractiveness is complicated. We have so many ways to dress up men and women with cosmetics and clothes and behavior and putting, you know, me in different situations and candlelight or whatever it might be, that many, many things go into whether a human male or female will find another human attractive. In animals, it's a little simpler. You know, a male zebra finches don't appear on the cover of GQ magazine. They don't have all that cultural baggage. And so it's easier to see these phenomena. But from an evolutionary standpoint, attractiveness is associated in a certain way with health and fitness. And now, it's not a simple connection. Somebody could look very attractive and be dying of some hidden disease. But in general, when people are sick or not feeling well or have a chronic illness, they don't look as good
right
as people who are healthy and fit, right? So the mother makes the smart assumption in a zebra finch that an attractive mate is going to be healthy and have good genes for her offspring. So she's more eager to meet with him, to mate with him than with another, because that gives her kids, so to speak, their best shot.
That actually makes a lot of sense, but I'm going to offer another explanation, and I want your response to this. Now, I believe that when a woman who is looking to get married and is not looking to simply marry a prototype or to change her status because everyone else is getting married and she feels, you know, she feels she has to get married too, when she marries someone that she's genuinely physically, sexually, and emotionally attracted, she's actually happier and she doesn't punish the father, and therefore where there's less conflict in the house and the offspring actually benefit from being in a house where there's a lot of love, there's a lot of healthy sexual energy, and there's a lot of appreciation.
Well, I think that actually fits. I mean, I don't know particular data that speaks to that precise question, but I think that fits if you know, so you're talking about the quality of the relationship.
Exactly.
Between the male and female.
When a woman, you know, marries a man who she's not attracted to, he looks good on paper, what happens is resentment builds up, and that resentment and that disconnection and that lack of, you know, I really am passionate, actually affects the child, because the child doesn't know why there's such a low level of energy and everyone wants to run away as opposed to stay together.
Well, you know, I think the way to kind of reconcile what you said and what I said is that, you know, seeking out good genes in a mate, you know, a healthy mate. So for example, if you know, if one of us was looking at a mate or two, you know, I don't know, the hypotheticals are a little tricky, but, you know, if you looked at two potential mates, and one of them had a history of heart disease in the family, and every male, you know, died at 45, and the other one didn't. Well, that would certainly be a consideration you'd want to take into account when making a mate choice. Obviously, it doesn't break down that way, but you know, if you know there's a lot of illness in a family, if a man is entering a relationship with a woman and she says, you know, my mother and my grandmother both died of breast cancer at 35, he might stop to think about that. And, you know, should he make his decision based on that? No, these genes are only part of the reason that we choose the mates we choose. And you're right. You can, one could choose a very healthy, fit mate with a great family history. And if there's no love and attraction there, that's going to be a bad choice. But so, seeking out a healthy, fit, genetically, fit partner is part of what we look for.
Yeah, I think there's a connection to both. I don't think they're actually against one another. I think they actually go together. Let me ask this.
I agree.
How do mother's genes and father's genes actually compete in the fetus itself?
So I'm glad you asked about that. That was one of the more interesting things that I found. So I think we have this notion, again, you know, the sort of things we carry around in our heads that that when, you know, two people decide to have a child, it's a wonderful thing, and that the biology somehow reflects, you know, that decision. It's just two people we're presuming here who choose to have a child, not who are surprised by pregnancy, but two people who choose to have a child. Such parents or prospective parents are often very happy, and so we think that, well, the biology, you know, the biology takes, it runs its course and everything runs smoothly and it's a beautiful process, and you see that developing fetus on the ultrasound and it's amazing and all of these good things. Well, it turns out that the biology is far from this harmonious spectacle that we might imagine, and that the biology is really kind of cutthroat. And the reason is that men and women, males and females, among humans and among many animals, have a different strategy for their offspring. So, males can in theory have many, many, could have hundreds or thousands of offspring. And biology works toward that end. Females can't do that because they've got to spend at least nine months with each one, and presumably a number of years after that. So it's harder. So what fathers want to do to pass their genes on to the next generation is sort of have as many offspring as possible. Mothers want to conserve their resources so they can have as many as is possible for them, but that's going to be a much smaller number. So their genes over millions of years have evolved to reflect these differences. And so fathers now, when a woman becomes pregnant, some of the genes that fetus has were contributed exclusively by the father. And these genes have been identified and they can be tracked. And those genes can control the mother's metabolism and physiology. So the father on that, for that particular child, wants that child to be as big and grow as fast and as possible and consume as many resources from the mother as possible, because particularly in the animal kingdom, that male and that female may never encounter one another again. So the male strategy is to have the mother give as many resources as possible to the offspring. He doesn't care if she's not able to have more children later or becomes depleted or something.
Interesting.
That's going to be some other male involved there. Paul, are you with me so far?
I'm with you completely, but Paul, let me ask you a question. How does it explain that in some societies, especially in Europe and also in Japan, and in some cases, in parts of the United States, there are men and women who are choosing not to have children? Meaning, has something gone wrong with evolution, or are we reaching a point where, from an evolutionary standpoint, there's this inbuilt sense that population growth is getting to a dangerous level? Like, why are people choosing not to have children?
I don't know the answer to that. I didn't look at that, because this book was about what fathers contribute to their kids.
Okay.
So I looked exclusively at those who did. But I would, you know, offer an observation, which is that, you know, if in evolutionary terms, we're only here for one reason. That's to pass our genes on to the next generation. That's the process. That's the natural biology. That's the way it works. But culture is a different thing. This is a recent phenomenon, you know, in we're, now we're culture, we're talking thousands of years, evolution, we're talking millions of years, and culture comes along and people make decisions and they can, you know, overrule that biological impulse because of what they've learned or what they've come to believe, and that's fine. And in fact, you know, culture and, you know, evolutionary drives, you know, can interact, and it just takes a long time for changes on an evolutionary scale. But, you know, certainly people can make those decisions, and we're not absolutely bound by our genes to do what our genes demand us to do. It's not that simple.
Interesting. Paul, I'm going to ask you a question that is in your book that most of the people who hear this, some of them are going to want to commit suicide, and just kind of, it's going to have an effect on them. You say in your book that fathers who devote more resources to their children have smaller testicles. Now, why is that?
Well, there's some kind of inverse relationship between testosterone and child rearing. So one of the things that happens during...
This is absolutely true. This is scientifically proven.
So there are a couple of pieces of it. You know, the one study that found the smaller testicles associated with, greater propensity toward child rearing is also smaller testicles are associated with less testosterone and so forth. So those are associations. So they look at people and measure things and measure testosterone levels and physical size and so forth, and they come up with associations. Now, that does not give us any information on why that might be the case.
Are you sure it's not that fathers who marry bitchy women have smaller testicles? I mean,
well, I don't know of any studies that actually look at personalities of parents in that way. The ones that I saw were strictly physical physiology. But there's another interesting piece of this, which is that when a couple becomes pregnant, when a woman becomes pregnant, if her partner spends a lot of time with her, then he will experience a sharp drop in testosterone during the pregnancy.
Interesting.
Now, this thing is happening. It's a little bit mysterious how it happens. But the thinking is, again, from evolutionary terms, that testosterone, this is an oversimplification, but testosterone is, you know, tends to be associated with competitiveness and mate seeking, which is what males do, you know, before they mate. They look for the closest they can get to the ideal mate. And so they need that competitiveness and that drive. Once they found a mate and it's time to reproduce, they don't need that. That testosterone drops. A hormone called prolactin, which is associated with nursing and mothers, rises. And men seem to be shaped into more nurturing and less competitive creatures, and evolution has apparently set this up because it's better for the offspring. Now, we all know lots of fathers who are, you know, have children and are wickedly competitive in their jobs and so forth. Any given major athlete who has children might seem to, challenge this association. But, you know, this is something that researchers have seen, and it makes sense, again, once it's been discovered and explained, that evolution would prepare people to become parents when it's the right time.
Now, let me ask you something that's a part of my experience, and tell me what the theory behind this is and whether I'm unusual in this. When both my children were born, it actually took me a couple of weeks to fully bond with them and to feel like, you know, this is my child. I mean, I love them in the sense that, you know, I connected, but not to the extent that after 2 or 3 weeks, all of a sudden, they were part of me. Why the gap? Is that unusual for men, or am I just a bit strange?
Well, I don't know exactly how quickly that unfolds, but I can tell you something interesting about connections between fathers and newborns. It turns out that if fathers are present in the first hours and days after a child is born, now this is not what you're talking about, but just being there and, you know, reaching out a hand and holding the child and so forth, that those kids have fewer behavior problems in school. They do better making a transition to school, a whole series of things that are good because of something that happened even in the first hours or the first day or two. The other thing that's interesting is that children, infants, very quickly bond with their fathers, if we look at it in the other direction. So in some studies, a stranger was in a room, you know, an observation room with an infant, a 3-month-old infant, and the mother and father at the same time walked into the room, the infants more often than not reach for the father. And why was that? Even at 3 months old, the reason is because they had already figured out that dad was more likely to play with them and hoist them up in the air.
Exactly,
and
give them allowance. You know they went for the money.
That's right. So they've already figured out that mom and dad are different, and they've already started to bond with dad in their own way. So it's
saying this is just really genetics, built-in genetics.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. I was in the delivery room for both my children. One was a high forceps delivery. The other one was a C-section. And I was the one who took the child from my wife's stomach. And mm-hmm. I will tell you that there was a different experience when I was the first one to hold the child with my second child when there was a high forceps delivery and she was 4 pounds and they wouldn't let me hold her and they rushed her away. I would absolutely tell you that there was a difference. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so that's part of this bonding thing that I'm talking about, you know, the physical contact. There's a group in Africa called the Akka Pygmies, A-K-A. And these males in this group, I call them the best fathers in the world. And I'm not original with that, but that's what they've been called, and it sounds right. I think the statistic is 45% of their day, so almost half their day, they're within an arm's reach of their child. This is the fathers now. Even the children go with them on trapping animals and collecting food and all of those
things.
And
what are these, the Akka Pygmies?
Akka Pygmies, right. AKA is how it's spelled. Okay. Right. And so they spend an enormous amount of time with the children. They have a total bond with their children, and part of it is because they wear many fewer clothes than we do because of the warm climate. And so there is lots of skin to skin contact between when father picks up a child and holds it, their chests are together. There's all that contact. And that seems to be part of what's going on and why there's that tremendous affection.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. And why, by the way, are they the exception to the rule as opposed to the rule? And is there a correlation between modern culture and kind of third world culture that lends to third world culture having better parenting skills?
Well, that's a good guess, but it seems like that's not the case, because if you look at other hunter-gatherer groups, not all of them have this kind of thing. In fact, they're quite different from one to another, even in one region like Central Africa. They have very different customs with respect to their kids. So I don't know why. That's a good question, and I don't know why they are that way, but they've been studied a lot to try to find out what lessons they offer for the rest of us.
Interesting. We should start an Akma Pygmy service for babysitting. It might just work well in New York. Let me ask you a question.
Father's world's best babysitters.
I find in all the years I've been doing what I'm doing, that fathers who are in the delivery room and are part of the child's birth do exceptionally well, but many do not want to see the baby actually, you know, being pulled through their wife's vagina, because sexually it has an effect later on. Did your studies have anything, you know, did they take a look at that?
Well, the data that I saw shows that fathers being in the delivery room, or even I was in the operating room too for C-sections, and that being there and being involved helps, is good for the family, is good for the relationship between the father and the child. I did not look at the question of whether being there might affect the parents' sexual relationship, and so I just don't know the answer to that.
Okay,
but I do know, you know, we don't want to put fathers in a miserable situation so they're very unhappy while they're there. That's probably not going to be helpful. But, you know, with some education and some, you know, classes and, you know, discussion about what to expect, I would hope that a lot of men could prepare themselves for that and be able to enjoy it.
I wanted to make an observation, you know, based upon my experience. You say in your book that men cheat more than women. Now, doing executive life coaching in New York for 37 years. Now, maybe it's New York City, but women and men cheat just about as much, and it's a very high number. Do you think that there's a reason for that, because there's a socioeconomic dynamic to cheating?
You know, I that wasn't the subject of the book, again, and I mentioned it in passing. You know, again, from an evolutionary standpoint,
from an evolutionary standpoint, is there such a thing as cheating? Meaning, don't...
Well, you know, I mean, some animals mate for life and some don't. So I suppose if animals, you know, tend to mate for life and then that gets interrupted somehow, I suppose that might be called a version of cheating. But, you know, humans are in the middle. We don't mate for life. But yet we do mate for a long time in many cases.
In many cases.
Sometimes for life, you know. So, I think it's probably one of those areas where evolution and culture intertwine and come up with complicated, occurrences.
Which animals mate for life, by the way?
Well, now you're going to put me on the spot here.
No, I know lobsters do. I know that they actually hold each other's hand until the day one of them dies.
Well, you know, I'm tempted to say swans because that's kind of a cliche, but I don't actually know if that's true. So I better stay away from that one or I'm going to get in trouble. I'll get us both in trouble.
Trust me, trouble's my middle name. talk to me about, you know, about how a father who has not had a good father and has not had any example as a father, how can he learn to be a good father other than picking up your book?
Well, that's, I'm glad you mentioned the book because I do, you know, address the things that fathers can do for their kids and in a lot more detail than we're able to get into here. So that's good stuff to know. But again, you know, it's a question of culture and learning. We are fortunate that unlike a lot of other animals, we communicate so we can talk to one another about, what's good and what's bad for our families and our children. We can learn things. We can make changes. We can, overcome to an extent some of our natural tendencies. A man is the kind of person who's prone to explosive anger. He can learn to control that or at least minimize that or make it happen less often. Just as, you know, people who are, you know, addicted to substances or alcohol or something can't always fight that, but they can sometimes and often overcome that. So that's where we're different from the other animals in the animal kingdom, that we have language and culture, and even those who are raised by bad fathers can, you know, we know that that kind of thing tends to be passed on. So if a man is aware of that, is treated very harshly by his father, he can read and learn that he's at risk of doing that to his children and try to prepare for that and hopefully find a mate who, you know, will help him and he can be much better off.
Now, I'm going to step out and say something, and tell me what you think of it. I think that monogamy, when fathers are monogamous, they actually help become better fathers, and they have a more secure home. Would you agree or disagree?
It goes back to the quality of the relationship. I think the quality of the relationship between the parents is paramount, or certainly one of the most important things. And, you know, if there's extramarital affairs going on, that's going to affect the quality of that relationship. Even if everything is kept hidden and confidential, it's bound to affect it. So, yeah, that's a problem for the kids, no question.
So let me ask you this. Girls, you know, get a lot of their sexual identity from their father. The more father, I know I'm extremely close with my children, and they've, you know, they just were very confident in their relationships, you know, with men. But in terms of boys, is there evidence suggesting that fathers instill masculinity in their sons rather than the mothers?
Well, that's been studied a little bit less, but it seems that might be the case. So I could tell you an interesting study with daughters, which is that if a father is out of the house, either through divorce or if a father's died or something, the father's not in the house, daughters will enter puberty earlier, significantly earlier, than than if their father is there.
Very interesting.
Puberty earlier is associated with more with riskier sexual behavior, higher chance of becoming pregnant as a teenager, and you know all kinds of other unfortunate things along that line. So, you know, just the presence of a father. This is not has nothing to do with what he says to his daughter or kind of a newbie kind of relationship, but just having the father present is important in guiding something like entry into puberty, which is a primal physical process that no women can control that or girls can control that, but something about the presence of fathers can control it. Now, similar research hasn't been done with sons, but the thinking is that with regard to sons, presence of the father may make them, you know, more competitive, more socially adept, more able to compete in the world. In other words, to do the things that males, you know, at least for millions of years, were more likely to do. So that, you know, the people who did the research on daughters haven't yet looked at sons, but they're doing those studies now, and it'll be very interesting to see what they find.
So if fathers give 100% and really put everything out there for their children, are they more effective than mothers who do the same?
I don't think they're more effective. I think they're different. I think ideally, two parents. Here's where I want to clarify. But two parents, a male and a female, is the ideal situation because that's what millions of years of evolution have prepared us for. If either parent didn't contribute to the welfare and the survival of the offspring, that parent wouldn't be around. Evolution over millions of years would have said, we don't need that parent. One parent can do the job. Now, I quickly add that single mothers and single fathers can raise healthy and happy kids. There's lots of research that shows that. There's lots of research that shows that gay and lesbian families can raise healthy and happy kids. So to say that, you know, the sort of typical and, you know, situation that arises out of evolution as a man and a woman is true, but that does not mean that other arrangements can't work too. And frankly, single mothers will be the first to tell you that they would rather have another parent around to help them out than to have to do
a lot
of work.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question. What is the difference between fathers who have children very young, like myself, and fathers who now are having kids because they economically could afford them in their 45s or 50?
Well, you're talking to one of those, so I'll come clean right at the start here. So I have grown children from a first marriage and two young children from a second marriage. And so here's the story on older fathers. The children of older fathers have some clear-cut increased health risks than the children of younger fathers. So children of older fathers we know that children of older mothers are at increased risk for Down syndrome. Children of older fathers are also at increased risk of Down syndrome.
I didn't know that. That's actually true?
The risk is on both sides. So, yeah, that's right. We know about mothers. Everybody knows about mothers. That's a common thing.
I didn't know about
fathers. People don't know about fathers.
No, I didn't know that.
And check the book and you'll see with references there and so forth. So that's true. Also, the children of older fathers have an increased risk of autism. They have an increased risk of schizophrenia. And, you know, we have this increase in autism in our society now that people are trying to explain. And one recent study suggested that the increasing age of fathers, because fathers are getting older, men are having children later, the increasing age of fathers might be enough by itself to explain the rise in autism. Now, a lot of other people have different theories. Not everybody agrees with that, but it's worth thinking about. And so should older men not have children? That I can't go there.
Too late for you.
So many reasons. It's too late for me, number one, and you know where I stand. There are so many complicated reasons that go into whether or not people have decided to have children or decide they shouldn't have children, and this is one of them. So my argument in Do Fathers Matter was these facts about older fathers are important and older men should know about them.
So there is an actual biological clock for men.
There is a biological clock for men, there's no question. And the to get into the biology a bit, you know, sperm are manufactured new all the time. So the thinking was, how could there be a biological clock? These are always, you know, newly made and they don't get old. Unlike women who have all their eggs when they're born that they're ever going to have in their lives, and those eggs get older as the women get older. So it turns out in men that what gets older is sperm-making machinery. Cells called spermatogonia age with men, and as men get older, those sperm-making machines tend to make more mistakes.
Now, let me ask you a question, and I haven't noticed this, though I think intellectually it should be true, but I haven't noticed it, that great fathers and great mothers don't necessarily mean the divorce rate, you know, changes.
Yeah, I don't have any data on that. I'm not terribly surprised by that, but I'm saddened by that.
Yeah, I'm saddened by that as well, but which is kind of interesting. But I do think very strongly from extensive experience that great fathers and great mothers who take the time to have a great relationship do raise healthier children. And that is something that they do contribute to their children to give them an example of what a healthy family looks like. And I do think that should be part of what people should consider.
I agree. And I have kind of a funny story to kind of wrap up on that note, if you want. When fathers play with kids, they experience a rise in oxytocin. Now, this is a hormone associated with relationships and bonding and so forth. Much, much maligned in the popular press and much overused and so forth. But it does have an association with relationships and emotional connections. So there's no evidence to support what I'm about to say at all. But if fathers playing with kids raises their oxytocin levels, that might help them bond better with their spouse, right? So the cheap marital advice here is, if you want to have a better relationship with your husband, get him to play with the kids more.
You know what? I'm going to take it one step further. If you want to have a better family, everyone should play.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Paul, your book is amazing. Everyone should pick it up. It has some facts that no one thinks about, and I truly appreciate you taking the time to do this interview.
No, it's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it.
You have a great day, Paul.
You too.
I want to once again truly thank Paul Raeburn for coming onto my show. Pick up a copy of his book, Do Fathers Matter, on Amazon.com, and also visit his website at paulraeburn.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. I want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. I want you to keep listening and sending us your feedback. Till next time.